Okay, that sound was our signal to start. good afternoon, Deli. My name is Deli Breton. I am a professor and chair of public health here at UC Irvine. And we always find new people to join us for different topics for our seminar series. So for those who are here for the first time, we thank you for coming. Wherever you saw the ad, let us know so we can continue to distribute the announcements accordingly. This seminar series made possible because of the network that our faculty members, students and staff, and sometimes members of the community have built over their careers in many cases. We tried to schedule them a year in advance, and sometimes we have to take a rain check and reschedule them. And today's presentation is by somebody we've been planning to bring here for some time. And it's thanks to the work of Dr. Brandon Brown, who's here hosting the speaker today. He'll tell you a little bit more about his interactions with the speaker and how they met, and introduce him more formally. I also want to thank the Office of Extension for helping us reach a broader audience and meet in this room every other week. These seminars are archived in our OpenCourseWare, and one of the emails that I forgot to send Brandon this morning was that we now have 4 or 5 years of seminars, and we have a UC TV channel dedicated to global health, and many of the topics that we've covered that recorded could be packaged into the UCTV channel. So I was gonna ask if you and Sandra can help us look at the topics and tell us, you know, build models. So that's, now you have the email. Anyway, please join me to welcome Dr. Brandon Brown, who will introduce the speaker.
Thank you, Deli. So the introduction is a little bit long, but it's also very exciting for me. So it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, my colleague and friend, Dr. Jerome Gallia. Dr. Gallia is the Director of Strategic Programs at Partners in Health, Branch in Lima, where he oversees research and implementation projects focusing on multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, early childhood development and chronic diseases, and HIV. Jerome's academic career started with his attaining a BA in psychology from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. In the early 1990s, he began working in HIV prevention in urban Detroit, which included hanging out at bars late at night and passing out condoms. Very exciting work. After briefly flirting with his life as a barista, he started working for the University of Washington on a project that would in some way land him here today. The project was helping to establish HIVNet, a vaccine preparedness study that was gearing up to test the first HIV vaccine, which was predicted to be ready at any time. The year was 1995. The vaccine never happened. But there was plenty of research, and over time, Jerome worked on a variety of projects aimed at preventing or treating HIV infection, earning a master's in social work along the way. By happenstance, in 1999, he met a Peruvian MD who was starting an NGO in Lima to address an HIV epidemic, which paralleled what was seen a decade earlier in cities like New York, LA, and San Francisco. While antiretroviral treatment was becoming increasingly successful and available in the United States, the same was not true in Peru, where access would not occur until 2004. Jerome was invited to Peru to transfer skills and knowledge for the successful implementation of HIV prevention research studies in the country, and by 2001 had relocated there to Peru full-time. From 2003 to 2006, Jerome lived in LA, serving as the Deputy Director of the Behavioral Epidemiology Research Group at UCLA School of Public Health. As a grad student, I was assigned to work with Peru to work with Jerry on posters, papers, and data analysis. I got to know him best by sleeping on his couch in Peru one summer to do some exploratory research at UCLA. He was later named the Latin American Regional Director for the UCLA School of Public Health, again based in Lima, from 2006 onwards. Since this time, He also co-founded the Gay Men's Community Health Center and STI Clinic, which is still in operation today, and which he continues to serve as a co-investigator with me on various projects. In 2009, he assumed his role at Partners in Health, leading a small project that enrolled and followed over 20,000 people, lasting 7 years. For his job, he has flown 1.9 million miles since 2002, for those of you who fly, and 110,000 miles in the past year. Just to put this into context, around the world, following the equator, is 25,000 miles. His direct research and experience centers largely on HIV prevention interventions, particularly biomedical interventions and their acceptability among men who have sex with men and transgender women in Latin America. After working several years in the field, he earned his PhD in HIV prevention science this past March from University College London, and his dissertation topic, about which you will hear more about today, explored the aspects that would affect uptake of microbicide gel to prevent HIV infection among likely users in Peru, Brazil, and Ecuador. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Jerome Gallia to UC Irvine.
I know, that was a lot. It's practically a presentation. Does that count against my time?
No, sir.
Okay. So, good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me. It has been about a year since Brandon first asked me, so I'm really excited to be here. Never been to UC Irvine. And always excited to talk about a topic that's near and dear to me for the past easily 10 years, rectal microbicides. I'm just curious, how many people show of hands, how many people have actually heard of microbicides just in general before today, let alone rectal microbicides? Okay, more than I would have guessed. So that's great. So for the rest of you, fasten your seatbelts. I'm going to tell you about rectal microbicides. But to put rectal microbicides in context a little bit, I think it's important to kind of look at where we're at in 2014. I got involved in the field in 2003 when things were a little bit different. Just a couple years ago, UNAIDS declared that we have halted and begun to reverse the epidemic. Fewer people are becoming infected with HIV, and fewer people are dying. In fact, about 14 million life years have been saved since 1995 because of the use of antiretrovirals. So there's really actually a lot to be proud of and to celebrate here in 2014. About 20% fewer people were infected with HIV in 2011 compared to 2001. So there's definitely been progress made. Several interventions are really, if they were scaled up, would make even a bigger difference in HIV incidence. Things like male circumcision, which confers up to 60% protection in heterosexual transmission. Treatment as prevention, that is, people who live with HIV that are treated are essentially non-infectious. They don't transmit virus if they're undetectable. Pre-exposure prophylaxis, the use of HIV antiretrovirals prior to exposure to HIV, and also some behavioral interventions that have been tailored and targeted to specific groups or vulnerable groups. So there's actually been a lot of progress. And so I think it's always important to start to frame things by saying, look at how far we've come. And yet, we're still faced with 7,000 new infections daily, about 32 million people living with HIV, 15 and above, over 25 million deaths since the pandemic started, about 95% of whom are living in developing countries, and we still have about 90% of people who don't know their HIV status. By any measure, HIV is still a global problem, and we still need to be finding solutions to solve that problem. So this slide here, actually this was a slide I was updating last night, but this kind of gives you a sense of where we're at today. And you can still see that in sub-Saharan Africa, it just dwarfs the rest of the world in terms of people living with HIV. This was the last UNAIDS report. I work, and I'll be focusing a little bit later on Latin America, but you can see that it's still a problem needing solutions. And what we have today, even with the great advances, still isn't quite making it. The other big thing that's becoming I would say it's becoming more publicized. It's always been a problem, but it's finally getting the attention, is that HIV disproportionately affects sexual minorities. If you look at South Africa, I showed the site a little bit, they have about a 5% HIV prevalence in adults, but if you look at men who have sex with men, for whom we have data, it's about 3.5 times higher than the general population. And yet, when we think of South Africa, we don't think of it as an epidemic amongst men who have sex with men. We think of it as a generalized epidemic, which it is. But it obscures these smaller and robust epidemics. Take a look at South and Southeast Asia, almost 50 times higher. But still, it's not what we're reading about in most epi papers that are published. And so if you look globally, in fact, men who have sex with men, and this is, I should say from the beginning, most of the data that we have now, this is beginning to change, says groups, men who have sex with groups, transgendered women with men who have sex with men, so the survey instruments aren't refined enough to capture the diversity. So that's why I don't include transgendered women here in these data. Hopefully that will change. We know for transgendered women it's probably much higher than that. But at any rate, 19 times higher. And so I'm kind of setting the stage for why, I haven't actually talked about microbicides yet, but why are rectal microbicides important? So I will get to that, but I want to make the point right out that if we're going to achieve this AIDS-free society, it needs to include everybody. And that means including men who have sex with men, implementing things at a broad level that can include social policies, but also biomedical interventions. So in the next 45 minutes or so, how much time do I have? Before my time is out, I'm going to talk about why, if we have condoms, why would we need new technologies? Microbicides, what are they? How do they work? Who would use them? Who's even having anal sex? You'd be surprised. Vaginas and rectums. It's something I need to touch on because there are vaginal microbicides and rectal microbicides. Some research highlights. I'd like to talk about some of my work in Latin America, and then also tell you about advocacy, which has really been the motor that's driven rectal microbicides to where it's at today. So let's start from the beginning. If we have condoms, and they work, and they do, if they're used consistently and correctly, condoms can confer up to 95% protection, then why do we need new prevention strategies? Well, they don't work all the time for everybody, and they're not used consistently and correctly all the time. And then the slide that a friend Roger lent me, he's listed out. I won't go through all these little branches, but you can see there's just a whole host of barriers to condom use. Social barriers, structural barriers, cultural barriers, rumors, myths, misconceptions, individual factors, and so on. And so condoms often work if they're used consistently and correctly, but they're not solving, they're not curbing the epidemic, and they're not used at any rate at the rate sufficiently to blunt and turn the epidemic around. So this made me think about something that a friend and colleague, Tom Coates, said a few years ago at a conference. He's saying, you know, if you were treating HIV, you'd never rely on just one strategy. You'd rely on multiple strategies. You try to bring everything together and try to combine them. It would be like using ineffective monotherapy to treat HIV, which was done in the 80s and early 90s. It didn't work. That's why we have triple combination therapy now. And it is doomed to failure. And so when you think about it, combination prevention really is something that's, it's not a new concept. We use it. Probably most of you were involved in a combination prevention intervention today, depending on how you got here, if you came in a car like we did. You know, in cars, combination prevention is where it's at. You have seatbelts, but you don't just rely on seatbelts. There's airbags that will come into play. There's also speed limits. If you obey them, they're there to help prevent deaths. There's guardrails. Shouldn't use your cell phones. Shouldn't drink and drive. All of these synergize to prevent deaths in the use of an automobile. And so really, When we think about HIV prevention, we don't think about just the almighty condom. We think of a toolbox of things that we could use, hopefully together, maybe not always, but that would synergize to prevent new infections. And so if we had a complete toolkit, this is what it might look like. And actually, we do have a toolkit. If we used all the tools we had in our toolkit, we'd have prior to exposure, point of transmission, and treatment. And the things I've placed here in black are things that we already have and are tools that we could be using and synergizing. We don't always do it, but we could be. The things I have in red are things that are still under development, like vaccines, vaginal and rectal microbicides, and therapeutic vaccines. So my message, even though my talk is about rectal microbicides, my message is, and I'll repeat it over and over, is that I look at rectal microbicides as an important tool that we're developing to add to this toolbox. I'm not saying stop use condoms. I just think that they can be supplemented and added to, says Angry Cat. So, what is a microbicide? So it's a product that is applied in the vagina or the rectum that would offer protection against HIV and maybe even other sexually transmitted infections. It would be nice if there was also a contraceptive version. It would be nice if we could also develop them to prevent other sexually transmitted infections as well. It would be nice to have versions that were based that were just targeted towards HIV and others that were broader than that. They could be formulated as a gel, lubricant, vaginal ring, and rectal microbicides could be also delivered as gels, lubricants, douches, or suppositories or enemas. It really depends on the market. The idea is to have different presentations for different user types. And so here's some pictures of the different types of presentations. You could have gels, rings, films that would dissolve, suppositories, or enemas. So just to emphasize, vaginal and rectal microbicides are under development. They're not actually available today. They're in advanced clinical trials. Vaginal microbicides are, and rectal microbicides are in mid-stage clinical trials right now. So how do they work? So the concept is pretty straightforward. There's different mechanisms of action to prevent HIV infection, and just in the same way that, say, antiretroviral drugs attack HIV at different points, the microbicides that are under development today, which are made out of the same antiretroviral drugs that are used to treat HIV infection, they're made into compounds that could be applied topically. In fact, some people are calling rectal and vaginal microbicides topical PrEP. PrEP is the use of antiretroviral medications that you would take to treat HIV. You take them before you're infected with HIV, and the idea is it would prevent it. And so that's called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP. The idea is that you would take these compounds and make them topical. And you have two broad types of microbicides, or two classes, broad spectrum and those that are HIV specific. And I'll show you in this cartoon how they might work. The cartoon's coming up, but the broad spectrum ones basically prevent HIV from entering healthy cells by creating a physical barrier. They can kill the virus, but they don't actually interact with the virus, the actual different molecules of the virus. Whereas the ARV-based microbicides, the antiretroviral-based ones, they actually block specific proteins and protein receptors, just in the same way that all ARVs work. And here's the cartoon. You can see in a non-specific one, basically the little polymers, they attach to the HIV and deactivate it, whereas in the specific ones, they break into the proteins and prevent binding. And that's the difference between the two. So in this slide, Roger's also laid out the main components for microbicides for HIV prevention, whether they're rectal or vaginal. They're different presentation types, which I've discussed, use, how they might work, challenges, design stage, and advantages. The real advantage with microbicides and a topical product to prevent HIV is that the idea is that you provide the person who's most likely to get infected with HIV, that you empower that person to have a tool that they themselves can use. One of the issues with male condoms, and one of the barriers to male condoms, is that the person who's wearing it doesn't always want to wear a condom. The receptive partner doesn't always have control as to whether their partner wears condom. And so the idea is that you would have this option so that, okay, if you don't want to wear a condom, that's fine, but I can still protect myself by putting in a vaginal or rectal microbicide. So that's part of the idea. So then why the interest in rectal microbicides specifically, and who exactly is having all this anal sex? So 2 points that I'll make is that it will come as no great surprise that the rectum and the vagina are actually different to each other. I'll tell you more about that. I'm not just joking. We all know they're different, but they're different in specific ways that has implications for microbicides. But also that anal sex is quite common. Both heterosexual and homosexual anal sex is common. It's taboo. That's also pretty common. But these products aren't just intended for men who have sex with men. They're intended for people who have anal intercourse. And anal intercourse is a human behavior. So men and women, heterosexual and homosexual, practice anal intercourse. And there's been a lot of literature on the issue. I found this last night, even from Sesame Street. Now, that's actually a real book. But no, that's not really what I want to say. So heterosexual anal intercourse. My own research focuses on men who have sex with men and transgendered women in anal intercourse, but I want to make the case that we almost always think of anal intercourse as, you know, this gay thing, but actually it's a human behavior. And there's a lot of data to back it up. About 10% of the general population practices anal intercourse, and it's even higher in certain in data sets from the U.S. where 30 to 50% of women with other HIV risks, say drug use, engage in anal intercourse. So it's frequent, and frequency of condomless anal intercourse is much higher in heterosexual population than in the gay and MSM populations, at least in U.S. data. Here's a couple slides. This one's dated, but I think it's interesting nonetheless. It's still from 2002, but this was a questionnaire that was looking at the different types of sex that heterosexuals had in the U.S. These are different types of sex, but I'm pointing out here, this is amongst males, 40% had ever had anal intercourse with the opposite sex partner, and female, 35%. These are significant. This is another data set from colleagues at UCLA. This is looking at anal intercourse among young heterosexuals, and percent reporting anal intercourse ever and within the last with the last sex partner in three cities. You can see the evers are still, you know, even the last partners are still higher than what we usually read about. It's not just in the U.S. It's a global thing. I found these slides from Brazil, 40%. This is a general population, heterosexuals reporting ever anal intercourse, also from South Africa. So what we hear more often about, because it's more implicated in HIV transmission, is homosexual anal intercourse. And in the U.S. and the U.K. And elsewhere, although data from other countries is still pretty scarce, it's very frequent, 76 to 90% in U.S. gay men and MSM cohorts, 50% in the UK. That was in a gay men's health survey, and others. This was the point I was making earlier, is that gay men and men who have sex with men still make up the bulk of new infections in the West, actually within Latin America as well. But we know much less about what's happening in places like South Africa, the Middle East, Asia, because of stigma, homophobia, and so forth, that prevents accurate data collection and people accurately reporting the sexual behaviors they have. So the thing with anal intercourse is that it's, in terms of HIV transmission, it's way more, it's a lie, it's a, oops, hit this button, let me go back to Yoda. An act of a condom with anal intercourse is, predictions have been up to 20% more likely to transmit or to result in an HIV transmission than an act of unprotected vaginal intercourse. And I'll explain why that may be in a moment. This slide here shows different types of exposures for HIV and the risk per 10,000 exposures. And you can see that receptive anal intercourse is pretty high up there. Right after the blood transfusions, needle sharing, receptive anal intercourse is right at the top. And so it happens that when you're in a high prevalence area and you for HIV, and you have a condomless receptive anal intercourse, the risks of being infected are much higher. So a little bit about rectums and vaginas. This is kind of rectums, vaginas 101. And one of the things that makes the rectums and anal sex so much riskier for HIV transmission begins right with the cell, the number of cells. The vaginas are just, they're built to last. You know, they're tough. They've got a lot more cells, about 40 cell layers thick in most areas, with only one layer in the rectum. So if you have when you have anal intercourse, you are disrupting those cells, and there are tiny lesions, and that just happens. There's only one cell, and so it's very easy. But also, these CD4 cells, there's fewer in the vagina, but there's more in the rectum. And these CD4 cells are targets for HIV. They're kind of like a welcoming committee for HIV. And so you've got this very thin, very friable epithelium in the rectum, and they have all these CD4 cells in the rectum just kind of waiting to greet HIV. And that's those two things alone are thought to play a major role in the risks for anal intercourse. Also, pH is more hospitable to HIV in the rectum, and the physiology of the vagina having this closed pouch as opposed to this long tube means that there's just more surface area for infection to happen. Betty White once said, I'll let you read it, but I'm joking, but it's true. Vaginas are just tougher, and they can handle a lot more. So let me tell you a little bit more. We're going to dig down a little bit deeper into rectal microbicide science, and I'll give you an idea of where we're at. I mentioned at the beginning, some people are starting to call microbicides topical pre-exposure prophylaxis. The main difference between taking antiretrovirals to prevent HIV infection and as a tablet, or using them as a topical agent, has to do with the concentrations of the drug that would end up either in the blood or in the rectal tissue. So the main difference is that if you take an oral antiretroviral, the highest concentrations are in the blood, and by the time it gets down to the tissues, it's a little bit lower. Whereas the idea is that for topical, it would not be a systemic drug levels in the blood. You can actually detect them, but the highest detection is going to actually be at the point of infection. And so these have different implications. It could be that somebody who's constantly at risk for HIV, say because of commercial sex work, may do better with having something always present in their blood using an oral product. Whereas for somebody who needs just occasional prevention, may opt more for a topical. Or maybe they'll use them both. I mean, these are the things that are being looked at now. So a little bit look at where we're at in the rectal microbicide field. To talk about rectal microbicides and where they're at, I need to mention the different types of studies that happen. Really what happens with rectal microbicides is that they start out at the idea phase, test tubes, animals, and they do go through what's called a preclinical phase of testing. Then, and these don't happen in humans. Then the early trials start with very few people, just looking to see if the product is safe, but not really looking to see if it works. So these happen in very small groups of people, maybe 25 to 200 people. These are called phase one clinical trials. Then they move on to phase two expanded safety trials. And in these trials, they last a little bit longer. They have 200 to 800 people. And in these trials, what you're starting to do is start to understand their expanded safety, so they're used longer, the products, but also you start to understand how people would use them, and you start to get a beginning sense of whether they might have the reactions that you'd want them to have, whether they would begin to give a signal of efficacy. After those trials, then they continue on progressively until these big phase three trials, which are trials that are usually blinded trials, and the product is compared with a placebo trial or placebo or some other product to see whether the microbicide will really work. This is the same process that's used for drugs, pharmaceuticals, not just for microbicides. Right now, rectal microbicides are at phase two. That means that they're currently, today, enrolling, right now they're enrolling men who have sex with men and transgendered women in five different cities for a phase two trial of a rectal microbicide product to see, to look at its safety. So there's been a fair amount of rectal microbicide work, nowhere near what's happened in the vaginal microbicide field. Mostly in phase one, the UC7081 product can't be developed any further. It was an early rectal microbicide that was tested. Then there was a vaginal tenofovir gel that was used. This was a product that was tested in a large trial called the CAPRISA study. You may have heard of it. It had about a 39% efficacy in that trial. So it's not there are new trials happening, but the drug has not been licensed yet. That product was used with, they thought, you know, if it works vaginally, let's try it rectally. There were too many side effects. It wasn't well tolerated at all. And now they've developed an MTN017, this reduced glycerin vaginal gel that was safe and well tolerated, and that's the product that's being used right now in what's called MTN017. MTN stands for the Microbicide Trials Network. It's the NIH-funded network that is testing both vaginal and rectal microbicides. These are some friends of ours from Peru that are very happy that rectal microbicides are being tested in Lima and elsewhere. So here's where the sites are. Two sites in the U.S., one in Peru, South Africa, and Thailand. They're in the same geographical area, but they're broken up into different study sites within the same city. So there's 186 people in the study. By the end of this year, or maybe the beginning of next year, we'll start to have an idea of the expanded safety of that product. And if that product works, then it would go on to a new and larger studies enrolling many more people. Did just want to mention a little bit how this study is designed. I thought this was really interesting, and this is definitely a change from previous clinical trials. So basically what I wanted to show is that the MTN-017, so this microbicide trial that's underway, is having people take the 8-week period is split up into three different periods. And instead of using a placebo, they're using daily Truvada. And Truvada is an antiretroviral, an oral antiretroviral. And so they're comparing the use of this participant, for example, would use daily Truvada for 8 weeks, then take a break, then use the gel rectally, and take a break, a washout period, they call that, and then gel before and after sex. So they're trying different combinations to see which is the best combination. It's a way that these trials are moving. I think it's pretty interesting to try to get more out of the trial. And we already know that we know what these products would be compared to nothing already, because placebo in the absence of using these gels. And so the idea is that you compare it to things for which you already have data, like daily Truvada, which is used for oral PrEP. So basically what I'm saying is that more and more PrEP, oral Truvada is being used as the new placebo, the new standard of care. It's no longer ethical to completely withhold something from a product from someone when you know that it works. This study is going to, this will change the face. You heard it here first. This study will, if microbicides come to be, this will be the forerunner study. And I'm really excited about this study. But about the overall rectal microbicide timeline, these were the early studies I talked about. There are a few that are going on. But for the MTN-017, the product that's being tested, it's in phase 2 right now. We'll have some early data. And mainly what I want to show here is that by the end of this decade, if things go well, it's possible that we could have a rectally applied product to prevent HIV. And that's really exciting. And it then leads us to the next question. If you have this product, will people use it? If you build it, will they come? And it seems like an obvious question at first, but maybe not so much. You look, for example, at the female condom that's been around now for 20 years. Actually, it's just been relaunched, I heard last week, is the internal condom. Uptake is still really low on this product that could be used and controlled by the receptive partner. It can be used vaginally. It can be used rectally. But uptake has been really slow. Why is that? People have lots of different theories around that, but it points to the issue that just creating a new product by no means guarantees that it'll be used. And so I became very interested and now I'll switch to the part where I talk about the things that I do more directly. I became interested in this topic of, if you have rectal microbicides and the train is moving, how can we prepare communities for this new product? And what would be the things that would facilitate uptake of this product or act as barriers for uptake for this product? And when I started looking at the data, this is true for lots of things actually, but most of the data on rectal microbicides, which is still a niche field, is really only available in the US. And yet we know that HIV is not limited to the US, and that many other countries have HIV epidemics that are concentrated in men who have sex with men, and that a rectal microbicide would be used in these other contexts. And so if you look at Latin America, and this is I live in Peru, but if you look across, throughout Latin America, the adult HIV prevalence is, for the most part, below 1%. And in Peru, if you look at the HIV prevalence in men who have sex with men, it's 12.2% from these data. I point out Ecuador because it's also a country in which I've done work, and it's a similar thing. You have a low HIV prevalence in the adult population, but much higher in men who have sex with men. If you just drill down into Peru, so these now are data from, these are country-specific data from the country itself. The general population prevalence, quite low. Men who have sex with men, 12.4. Sex workers, male sex workers, 14.6. And transgendered women, 20.8. And so, really, this is an environment where rectal microbicides could have an impact. And if there are modeling studies that have actually looked at introducing rectal microbicides that have different effectivity levels and used at different rates, and if they were used often enough and had a high enough effectiveness, then they could definitely turn the epidemic around in these areas. So in other words, HIV prevalence for Peru is 31 times greater in men who have sex with men compared to the general population, 36.5 times greater in sex workers, and 52 times greater in transgendered women compared to the general population. So, last week, I was in the Microbicide Trials Network hosted a meeting called Creating Desire. And they invited me to speak at this meeting. And the purpose of this meeting was, and they had invited scientists from all disciplines, they had community activists, lots of people from around the country and the world, really, to talk about this very issue. If we make these rectal microbicides, what's the guarantee that people are going to use them? What can we do to start to create desire for these products? And how can we measure that? It's difficult to measure desire or acceptability for a product that doesn't actually exist. And we can't create 10 products to begin with. We really have to create the product right now. We're putting kind of all our eggs in one basket because it's time-consuming, it's really expensive, and involves thousands of people. We want to make sure that the products that we're developing have the best shot of being used by the people that they're intended to help. And so I was invited to talk about some work I've been doing on acceptability. And basically, the foundation of this is that it's not enough to ask people, if you had this product, would you use it? Oftentimes, simply asking somebody if they like it or would they use it gives you a positive answer, but then it doesn't really pan out in reality. And so it's basically the thesis here is that it's way more complicated, and there's unconscious and psychological processes that go into decision-making. And if we could just figure out how to measure the attributes, the characteristics that people most value, then we could be channeling that information into the developers so that the products that end up coming to market are ones that people would actually use. I think, you know, I became interested in this methodology called conjoint analysis that has nothing to do with vacuum cleaners itself, but it illustrates what I wanted to say. You might look at this vacuum cleaner and say, oh, that's a, you know, nice vacuum cleaner. And I might ask you, would you use this vacuum cleaner? You might say yes or no, based on what you see here in this picture as a whole. But if you look at this picture, it's kind of hard to read. This picture shows the same vacuum cleaner, but it's broken down into its various elements. And so now you're more apt to look at that vacuum cleaner and say, oh, this has an extra long crevice tool. I have very deep crevices that I'd like to vacuum. I'd like this because it has this characteristic. Or maybe you think, you know, this is, you know, overkill. I don't need all these characteristics. The point is that if we were able to look at products as their characteristics, then potential users would have more information in which to base their decision of whether they'd use that product. We actually do this sort of thing all the time with all kinds of products. If you've ever purchased a camera before or maybe a computer. I saw this on the Dell website, but they know this. They also, manufacturers of commercial products know this. They do this all the time. They know that different consumers have different choices and they're driven by different characteristics. And so if you're somebody who's interested in price, this website will show you products within your price range and so forth, color and so on. And so really, what we need is methodologies that helps us look inside someone's brain and help us understand why they're making a choice for a product. Conjoint analysis is that sort of methodology. And conjoint analysis basically breaks a product into its attributes and its values. So if I was looking at selling ice cream, my attributes would be price, receptacle, and flavor. And the values would be these different prices, cone or cup, and flavors. If I were selling, and this is just to explain how this process works, conjoint analysis. Basically, what it asks people to do is to compare different scenarios, different types of product presentations, and then it asks you to rate them from best to worst. So if I were selling a pain reliever, and I had a pain reliever that was had two attributes, cost and duration. Might cost $3 or $5, and it might last 6 hours or 12 hours. In this experiment, I would say, rate these from best to worst. And then when you rated those, I would be able to determine what was driving your decisions by running the experiment. Some people, you might think, well, it's obvious. $3, 12 hours, sure. But sometimes people choose more expensive products because they feel like it's better if I'm paying more. Or some people don't want long-lasting medication for whatever reason. And so the point is that we make trade-offs and we're willing to say, oh, this costs a little bit more, but it doesn't have any side effects. Cost is more important. I mean, this one is more effective, and so forth. And so I wanted to ask that question about rectal microbicides, still hypothetical, and I wanted to focus in these three cities in Peru which have high epidemics of HIV, Lima, Iquitos, which is in the jungle, and Guayaquil, which is in Ecuador, on the coast. And I made up these different, along with investigators to say, these different microbicides, and I was looking at cost, could be 30 cents or $5, formulation, gel or liquid, prescription, available over the counter or by prescription only, frequency of use, would this be a product you'd have to use every single day, or just before sex, effectiveness, 80% versus 40%, the presence of side effects, and also different volumes. And I asked people to rate these different scenarios, and then I could, that by doing so, it helped me understand which of these attributes and their values were the most important for rectal microbicides in these settings. So I created 8 different scenarios. I won't go through the statistical finessing. If you actually had all these attributes and values, you'd have like 150 different combinations. People can't really work with 150 combinations, they can with 8. I created these 8 different hypothetical rectal microbicides, and I asked people to place them in order from best to worst. And that's basically what they did. They looked at cards and they put them on the scale. My population was 140 men who have sex with men and transgendered women. And amongst the men who have sex with men, there were some that identified as gay, some that didn't, and some that were sex workers. These were what they primarily identified was. Obviously, you could have a non-gay MSM that was also a sex worker, but these were discrete groups as they self-identified. And so the reason I focused on these groups is these are the groups that would be potential consumers of this product. What did I find? What I found was that effectiveness definitely, so these are your attributes, the characteristics and the values. And these scores here tell us that effectiveness was the most important attribute for rectal microbicides for the sample. I've ordered them down. Not too surprising. People are going to want a product that works. Next was the presence of side effects. That was the next most important. People preferred a product without side effects compared to products with. Also, not too surprising. What I did find interesting were some values here from Iquitos. In these samples here, the participants from Iquitos, this jungle city, they preferred a product that was available by prescription more than a product that was available over the counter. I mean, my hypothesis was it would be easier to go and buy a product over the counter in any pharmacy than to have to go to your doctor, have a discussion about why I want this product, go and get that prescription filled. And that was not true. In fact, they overwhelmingly preferred a product that was by prescription. Another interesting thing I found here was that the volume, 15 versus 35 milliliters, I had hypothesized that a lower volume would be more acceptable. But as it turned out, for the men and women in Iquitos, they had preferred a higher volume product. So when I dug a little deeper and I did some qualitative interviews, I found some potential explanations. This sex worker from Iquitos said, with regards to purchasing a product, you know, it's not the same as buying a condom because the people selling you them don't know with whom you're having sex. However, if it were a rectal microbicide, the clerk is going to think you're going to have anal sex. He's not going to think you're going to do that with a woman. He's going to say you're a fag, you're gay. So immediately, this brings up the idea of these products are going to face some barriers with regards to discrimination and stigma. It's going to be difficult, I found. And this is just one quote. There were several interviews and focus groups, but this was a theme that I believe is going to be a barrier to rectal microbicides, that there's going to be taboos around buying this product. You buy a condom, nobody really knows what you're going to do with it. You buy a product that's for anal sex, and automatically you're labeled. So that could be a barrier. And it could be that the people who preferred to get them by a doctor felt that that was at least a private place and that someone would recognize them. I mean, if they had competent care, that would say, hey, here's a product you could have, and they could more discreetly get them. This is also a very long quote, but I had to put it here. This is from a transgender woman. She says, you know, the vagina, the fact that there's a hole in a wall, but we have an anus, and the anus is long, long, right? If we introduce the microbicide, as it is called, I don't think that the microbicide is going to reach the entire width of, what's it called, the anal canal. So for me, well, that means that if they say that this is going to be beneficial for me, I would say it's going to be a lie, because the microbicide is not going to reach the entire anus. Besides, when he has a huge penis, ha, 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 it's not going to reach that maximum point. So the reason I put this quote up is, and again, I can't present, it would be a whole other talk. These data are, just came out 2 weeks ago in American Journal of Public Health, and so you're welcome to find the paper there. But there are barriers around plausibility, and the reason I particularly picked this quote is because some of the things that I found is that people felt that, you know, if I put a little bit of gel rectally, how is that really going to protect me? I mean, that's a long tube. And that, I think, has something to do with why we found that higher volumes might be more acceptable, because there might be the sense that, well, if it's a greater amount of liquid, at least it's going to cover and protect more than a few drops of gel. So this was a very small study. I think it's significant, but I think that we need to do bigger studies and combine conjoint analysis together in real time with qualitative data to try to understand what is really happening. My bottom line is that there are different things. People view things differently. There are cultural customs that are different. You know, we eat guinea pig in Peru. It's called cuy. And here in the U.S., it's a pet. And so, you know, the take-home message here around rectal microbicides, and for me and the work that I do, is that what works in one context or setting may not work in another context or setting. And so it's very important that when we create these products, that we understand the users not just by like penis and rectum, but understand their cultural context, where they'll be used and how they'll be used, and create products and market them appropriately. And we can do that by combining different types of research studies, qualitative interviews and focus groups, conjoint analysis, which I'm the type of thing that I've been using, clinical trial data, and also observational surveys. You know, in Peru, one of the reasons rectal microbicides even came to be as a thought is because the thought is, well, men of sex with men are already using lubricants. If we just add a product inside, a drug inside the lubricants they're already using, then it can prevent HIV. Well, what about in Peru where half the people don't use lubricants, where lubricants aren't really available and they're not distributed? And so these are the sorts of things that we have to really plan for by the end of the decade. If you want to read about this in more detail, go to PubMed. There's a growing literature on rectal microbicides, but not that much. But just PubMed, rectal microbicides, and the 30 or 40 articles that will come up, you can read much more about the acceptability work that's being done. So I want to end with a couple slides on advocacy. I got involved in rectal microbicide work really as an advocate for access to HIV prevention. And I don't think it was until I got involved in it that I really understood the power of advocacy on research. And so most of my advocacy work is research advocacy. And this group called IRMA, I became part of in 2005. It's the International Rectal Microbicide Advocates. And really, IRMA put rectal microbicides on the map, and they've heavily advocated for research funding. Right now, there's about 1,200 advocates, scientists, and funders around the world working in rectal microbicides. And advocacy work really is, we believe that this is a product that needs to be developed for all people, men and women, regardless of sexual orientation, regardless of gender. They need them, and that they can be used worldwide. And I didn't have time to show you this video, but we actually have a video that came out. It's 14 minutes. It's on YouTube. It's a really interesting video called The Rectal Revolution. And this short video talks about rectal microbicide science, but it also specifically gives more information on MTN-017, that phase 2 trial I mentioned earlier, and shows a little bit, including Peru, where the study is taking place and what's involved in a rectal microbicide trial. So if you Google Rectal Revolution or Google IRMA on their website, they have a link to that video. And that's what I had. Thank you for listening. So do we have time for questions?
A few questions. I have one. The clinical trial, I think I read somewhere how sophisticated the methodology is, and I'm sure it will set the baseline for what's to come. But for those of us who don't do this, what is the outcome? How? Because all these subjects are using some kind of prevention.
Right.
So what's the likelihood you'd get an outcome, which I imagine is somebody who got infected?
Or mm-hmm.
So what do you look for?
Because right. So in these early trials, they're more focused on, you're focused on two things. First of all, they're expanded safety. You, in the case of the gel, you're really counting different signals for adverse events, like
toxicity,
bloating, things of that nature. They're doing also, and this is the first study to do it, a test called PK monitoring. So they're doing real-time PK monitoring. So when people take the drug, they'll test their blood and they'll be able to see levels and adherence to that. It's really focused on adherence to the product and acceptability of the product and adverse events. They will look at infections, but the N is so small that they're not going to be able to really determine anything. But what they will determine is, you know, certainly if there's increase in infections, that sort of thing. But it's not an efficacy trial at this point.
Okay.
Yeah. Other questions?
So are most of the ones that are used the nonspecific, like the ARV, is one more effective than the other, like for the nonspecific?
So right now, the only microbicides under development are specific to HIV. And they're using antiretrovirals. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, we'll develop these multi-use products. I mean, wouldn't it be great as a woman to be able to have a microbicide that prevented against HIV, prevented against unwanted pregnancy, and be could used vaginally and rectally, and all in one? I mean, that would be the ideal thing. Right now, though, we've only gotten as far as developing very specific things. Any other questions?
It's time for lunch.
Okay, I guess so. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I think we have a little gift for you from our
faculty
and students. So,
congratulations. Yay, thank you.